Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bethany Gilbert, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Corumdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the sin of empathy.
The sin of empathy? Wait, empathy's a sin?
Apparently.
Hold on.
It's about to get provocative.
It's about to get real. Hey,
we might make Chris mad.
We're vamping off an article written by Joe Rigney from Bethlehem College and Seminary. The title of the article is "Do You Feel My Pain? Empathy, Sympathy, and Dangerous Virtues." And in this article, he mentions a previous article he wrote talking about the sin of empathy, which I just thought was a provocative idea. And so we're naming the podcast that because we want to provoke you to think about this. The whole scope of this article, or the whole angle of this article, is the difference between the words sympathy and empathy, and tapping into how that very subtle difference matters for how we think about what it means to love people. He starts out with Hebrews 4:15, which is that famous verse in Hebrews that talks about the fact that we have a high priest who is able to sympathize with our weaknesses. And he mentions that the Greek word there is the word we would expect, sympathizo. And the New American Standard, New King James, NET, ESV all use the word sympathize, but the NIV translates it this way. The NIV translates it this way. We do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses.
Man.
And he says, hey, is that that shift seems to mean something. These two words actually are a little bit different. And he says, obviously sympathy and empathy, in a lot of ways, they're synonymous. We kind of can use them interchangeably. We know what we mean. We mean the ability to feel with another person, to come alongside them in their grief or their pain or their struggle, to sort of extend a gracious and kind presence that comes alongside them in their suffering. Most of us know, okay, that's what we're talking about when we talk about these words. However, Joe Rigney wants us to think about the fact that there's actually a pretty important difference between the idea of sympathy and the idea of empathy. Sympathy is the idea of feeling with or suffering with. And empathy literally means to suffer in. And in this article, Joe Rigney footnotes Edwin Friedman's book, A Failure of Nerve.
Can't get too far away from that.
In fact, we got this article from a listener who had listened to the podcast we did a few weeks ago on coronavirus and a case study in anxious systems. And he said, hey, I was reading this article. This guy mentions Edwin Friedman. You guys should look at this and talk about it. And so let me read to you. Let me quote a few sections from Edwin Friedman's book, A Failure of Nerve. This is not Joe Rigney's article, but this is what he footnotes, a section from A Failure of Nerve. Here is Edwin Friedman describing empathy and telling us why it's concerning to him as well. Now, remember, he's writing not as a Christian, not as a theologian, but as a family counselor and a scholar who particularly is concerned for leadership and how anxiety in systems is toxic to well-defined leadership. Here's what Edwin Friedman writes. The word empathy is used often today by teachers, parents, healers, and managers. Few realize it only entered the English language in the 20th century. Compared to sympathy, which is 450 years old, and compassion, which goes back to 1340. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the word empathy was first employed in 1922. It was not until after World War II that the word empathy itself became part of common parlance, as it jumped from the realm of art appreciation to that of human relationships. It promised that projecting one's own person into the skin of another would enable one to understand the other person fully and to be more sensitive to his or her condition. But if sympathy has been in use for at least 450 years and compassion goes back almost seven centuries, are we to assume that English-speaking people suddenly became more sensitive to others in the middle of the 20th century? Or does the popularity of the word signify something else? Now, here's Friedman's conclusion. I believe that the increasing popularity of empathy over the past few decades is symptomatic of the herding and togetherness force characteristic of an anxious society. On one hand, there can be no question that the notion of feeling for others, caring for others, identifying with others, being responsive to others, is heartfelt, humanitarian, highly spiritual, and an essential component in a leader's response repertoire. But it has rarely been my experience that being more understanding of others causes them to mature. As understood today, empathy may be a luxury afforded only to those who do not have to make tough decisions. For tough decisions are decisions the consequence of which will be painful to others, although not harmful to others, which is an important distinction. The focus on need fulfillment that so often accompanies an emphasis on empathy leaves out the possibility that what another may really need in order to become more responsible is not to have their needs fulfilled. And again, this is Parenting 101. What your kids actually might need to grow up is to go without some stuff, to not have all their needs fulfilled. And he's just saying the focus on empathy implies that if I create any discomfort or painful circumstances for someone else, I'm failing to love them. And he is concerned that that is absolutely false, and that placing the focus on empathy rather than responsibility is toxic to leadership. Now, back to Joe Rigney's article, he is essentially making a similar point, saying that, hey, the language of empathy versus sympathy actually is really important. It does matter what we understand these things to mean and how we understand the work of helping, loving, walking with people to fit in these categories.
I appreciate that he's putting up a fight here. It seems at first, like when you're reading this article, that it's one of semantics when he's talking about being with somebody or in it, or the with or in language as kind of just minor things. But I actually see them as super helpful in leadership and in pastoral ministry. Circumstantially, I've definitely seen myself be too far deep into the quicksand, to use his analogy, in the empathetic side. But then I've also seen myself be differentiated and healthy on the sympathetic side. And it's important to know the difference between both. For instance, there's often times when I've even said to you, Bob, or other pastors or leaders around here, hey, this thing is just too close to my face, so I actually need another take, which is me kind of understanding, I think, in the moment of like, I think I'm sliding towards empathy here and I need to be careful. Don't let me go in all the way into the quicksand. His analogy of quicksand is helpful because he says an empathetic helper is somebody who just jumps in with both feet into the quicksand.
And just pulled in.
Yeah, and obviously that's a bad thing because now you have two people in quicksand and nobody outside of it to help. A sympathetic helper, on the other hand, is somebody who will step into the quicksand with one foot but keeps their other firmly planted on the shore. And that's kind of the emotional, or you could use the word differential, boundary in place. And so I think it's a helpful argument.
He obviously, all writing is done into a context, and what he's pushing back a little bit is the influence of Brené Brown, who, as you know, has been important in recent years writing on shame and also on sympathy and empathy. And Brené Brown argues that sympathy is bad and empathy is good. And essentially her case is sympathy implies a power relationship. It implies that, you know, you're the one suffering and I'm the one that can help you in your suffering because I'm only sympathizing with you, but I'm not in it alongside you. And so that it implies this, like, I'm going to be the helper. And she sees that as a bad thing. And, but Rigney points out, actually, if you read the fullness of her writing, she seems in some places to sort of like basically say what you just said, of like, actually, you can't be in the quicksand with a person. But I sense what he's trying to do here is bring a little bit of biblical corrective to that focus in the culture and to say, hey, let's actually embrace the idea of sympathy, not empathy, because if we're going to help people in the way the Bible talks about, that does involve not jumping in with them into the mire of their circumstances, but being able to be healthily differentiated.
It's also interesting to consider the way this emphasis on empathy has shaped the expectation of the sufferer too. Mm. Like, what do I want someone to do while they're caring for me, counseling, whatever it may be? And if my expectation is you sort of do get pulled into this quicksand with me and don't ever really challenge my perspective, just sort of validate what I'm feeling, then that if you're somebody who's trying to stay healthily differentiated, that can feel almost maybe disloyal or cruel if we kind of appear to be like not validating emotions. And so the struggle here too is not just with my tendency to sort of jump in with and maybe I have this need to help people, and so that can be kind of unhealthy. It's also on the suffering side, like, what is my expectation? Do I want to pull people? Do I need to be, self-aware of the ways that I can maybe drag people in and force them in. And if if there's kind of a self-awareness on both ends, hopefully that will navigate some of the pitfalls of what empathy can create.
I wrote down a little spectrum in my notes of apathy, sympathy, empathy, which are three words Joe Rigney uses. Think about what apathy is. It's an mm-hmm. it's an inability or unwillingness to feel with people. It's just, I don't care about your
checked
suffering.
Checked out. You're like right in the room.
Yeah. And sympathy would be the biblical perspective, and I think the healthy one. And then empathy would basically be enmeshment. So if we're going to lay Edwin Friedman categories over this, I think what Rigney's trying to say is empathy implies I'm kind of enmeshed with your pain in a way that's actually unhelpful to both of us. Sympathy implies a certain kind of differentiation where I can still come alongside you and feel with you, but I also have boundaries around myself and am able to sort of understand that though I'm coming alongside you and entering into your suffering and pain, I'm also not taking it on in what we would consider an idolatrous way, right? In a way that sort of causes me to try to be your savior or take the role of Jesus or bear your burdens in a way that the scriptures wouldn't ask me to do. So for me, it was helpful to think about apathy on one side, empathy on the other side, and sympathy as the healthy balance between those two poles. Oh, Bethany's going to say something, you guys. Go.
I'm going to ask a question. I don't know if you want to answer it. Go. Where and how do you guys see this play out with relationships in the church?
One of the ways that I see it play out is people want help, but if they want it in an empathetic way, they want help on their own terms, meaning they have an agenda with it, and they don't want me to keep one foot in the quicksand and one foot out of the quicksand to pivot. They actually come with an agenda, and if I can't meet that agenda or meet that quota, then I can't help them. So it gets kind of sticky there. It gets mm-hmm. kind of difficult. And obviously you got to navigate that and lead out of that. And
I've seen it, Bethany, in the sense that I think there's a tendency that scripture even warns us against to take up the offenses of others. Mm-hmm. So it's different. You know, think about someone who has been realistically hurt by the church, that has real grievances with pastors or church leaders or people in their story, right, that have harmed them. I want to come alongside that person and say, hey, I'm sorry that happened. And I want to help them try to find healing for that. And sometimes that might require going back and confronting people, or sometimes it just requires extending forgiveness for the stuff that is in my soul as a result of that. What I see people do that's unhealthy is taking that on as my own. Mm-hmm. And so now I become like, mm-hmm. I'm offended just like this person is offended. And I think what you're saying is interesting, Chris, that's more and more kind of what people expect is mm-hmm. like, hey, if I've been offended by something, mm-hmm. you should also be offended by it. Whereas a healthy differentiation would say, I understand why you're offended and hurt by that. That's not my personal experience. And so I'm not going to take on your offense or your hurt. I'm just going to enter in with you and walk alongside you toward whatever resolution of that would look like. Mm-hmm. And we've seen frequently in our experience pastorally of just people taking up the offenses of others and like demanding things on behalf of those people. That's just like, well, I'm not even necessarily opposed to what you're demanding. I just think it's weird that you're demanding it because yeah. you're not the person that is offended. Yeah. Like, you know, it's someone else.
Yeah. so many things to say to that point. It is an interesting dynamic, and it's a hard dynamic again, because you're trying to maintain this healthy distance and healthy perspective. And when you bring any sort of, I don't even know if it's correction, it's just perspective, it can sound as if you're downplaying or minimizing. It's like, no, I'm not minimizing anything. It's just, hey, we need to see the whole picture here. I think another way, at least I've seen this play out, and I know I've even, for me at times, have faced this challenge, is someone is hurting and we step into that situation and we have in our head, okay, don't be Job's friends. Don't be Job's friends. Just go be present with somebody, weep with them. I don't want to immediately jump into the, hey, let me tell you all the things you need to do. Let me diagnose why this is happening. You know, we don't want to be that person. So I think maybe we start to err on the side of empathy and we sort of just stay there. Even if we don't necessarily get enmeshed, we never really take that sort of the next steps of helping to walk with somebody and help them to really even proactively pursue healing. And so what ends up happening, I think, sadly, is it's not necessarily the person actually is healing. It's just maybe the emotion subsides. And so they've got a little more distance between what happened and the thing that caused pain. And depending on what that is, maybe that, you know, that emotion is still very much acutely present, but it keeps us from actually even being agents of, you know, on behalf of the Lord, of healing and redemption and walking with people, because that may require some hard conversations or asking some hard questions. And so I know I just want to be mindful as a pastor that my fear of not being Job's friends doesn't keep me from actually leading and caring for people in the way that they need to be cared for. And I want to encourage people in our church too, of like, hey, yeah, when you're first stepping in, it's probably just be silent, weep with them, sit with them, but walking alongside them actually means proactively walking alongside them and recognize that the time and place for that will come.
And what's important there, Chris, that I hear you saying without saying it, is that your emotions do have to be engaged in that.
Yeah.
You actually do need to feel something, but you don't have to feel exactly what they're feeling the way they're feeling it in order for you to be helpful.
And that's where, Bethany, as I was thinking about your question, if I were to say it in a sentence, I think what I've experienced is a demand from certain kinds of people that I validate their pain, right? And here's the challenge of that. Some of that pain is real and is caused by others' sin against them. Some of that pain is caused by themselves sometimes, right? And there, I mean, the old Paul Tripp phrase that sinners respond sinfully to being sinned against. I've been in some conversations recently with a person who is trying to describe, here's all the ways this other person has hurt me. And as I hear that, I'm like, okay, man, some of those are really, really valid. And then some of them are just like, nope, you had an expectation there that didn't get fulfilled. And that's not the other person's fault, right? So I need the freedom to be able to speak into that and say, hey, here's a set of things that I think there's real need for reconciliation with this other person. And also, here's some places where you just need to take responsibility for having unrealistic expectations. And actually, it's not the other person's fault. Almost any kind of relational pain in our lives has that dynamic in it. It's almost never 100% someone else's fault and 0% my responsibility. There's always in relationships some measure of, man, I mean, except in the most extreme cases, there's almost always some measure of, hey, some of the pain I'm carrying from this person has something to do with how I responded or reacted and, you know, things I've taken on. And so if I'm not free as a Christian friend to say anything about that, if all you want is for me to enter in and validate everything you're feeling, you actually prevent me from helping, you know, because there's a helpful brother or sister is going to want to enter into that and help me sort it out. Help me see, hey, what do I need to see here? And what does this other person need to see and own? Where is there a real need for reconciliation or confession or confrontation? And then where's there stuff that I need to own and deal with on my side of things?
Which I do think it is important to have, like to what you're describing, Bob, I would say that's a good friend. A good friend can bounce maybe between empathy and sympathy. But in the context of leadership, I definitely need somebody who's sympathetic. But I do think it's okay to have an entire tribe of people that, and we don't have to go down this train too far, but I do, or down this track too far. I do think it's important to have a whole tribe, which is friends who can just be in it with me, so to speak, to use that empathetic language, sympathetic leaders who can kind of lead me out of it or guide me through it. And also, sympathetic people who can guide and direct me maybe more specifically. Like if I'm having a marital issue, I need like a marriage mentor type of person, right? So to use that through that grid, Bob, that you were describing just a minute ago, from apathetic to sympathetic to empathetic, it's harder work to be sympathetic.
Yes, because it requires you to be differentiated.
Right. So what are some of the ways that I can get there? What are the ways? So like, if I'm apathetic, what are the things that I can work on to get sympathetic? If I am empathetic, what are the ways that I can kind of pull back to become differentiated to sympathetic?
That's an interesting question, and I don't know the full... You look like you have something to say,
Chris. I had a thought on one end of it.
Go.
I mean, it would seem that if you're feeling apathetic and then need to move to sympathetic, that category of compassion would be a significant role in this of what does it mean to cultivate the virtue of compassion for my brother or sister, or, you know, for my neighbor. That is going to move you towards the ability to be sympathetic, because you can't really be sympathetic in an emotionally engaged way unless you truly are compassionate and feeling compassion and have that virtue. So I think that's one, you know, how you develop compassion. Okay, that's another podcast, but I think that category should loom large in our minds. Yeah. If we're going to move from apathy to sympathy.
I can't even answer your question, Dusty, without thinking of categories of formation. Mm-hmm. And categories of sort of temperament. Because I think what's true is there's some people who are just going to, because of their either formation or temperament, are going to, their problem is going to be more apathy. Just like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm kind of out for myself. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to enter in too deeply. And those people the growth is going to need to be toward a greater love, a greater compassion, a greater openness, a greater entering into the suffering of others. And that's a certain kind of growth. There are other people who, because of their temperament or formation, they're going to lean more toward that. I want to take on everybody's burdens with them, you know? And there's sort of that, I can easily become enmeshed with people and kind of not know where their pain ends and where my person begins. And so the growth for them is going to be toward a healthy sense of self, you know, that rejects that sin of sort of trying to be someone else's savior, or of becoming so enmeshed in their pain that I can't sort of see clearly anymore. And so it strikes me that those are generally kind of, rarely does someone have both those problems at the same time. You're either 10 more toward apathy, or you tend more toward empathy. And sympathy is sort of calling us, all of us, to a different kind of center that I think does revolve around the virtue of compassion and around what we see in Jesus, who seems to embody for us this ability of feeling a real deep sense of compassion with people, but also an interesting self-differentiation. Think about, you know, him showing up at Lazarus's tomb and the sister is saying, if you'd been here before, he wouldn't have died. And him just being like, well, then you wouldn't get to see the power of God either. You know, he John weeps, 11, but he's also, you know.
Yeah, John 11 is just rich with layered meaning there of Jesus acts sovereignly. He knows he's going to resurrect Lazarus. He has this bigger purpose, which includes them suffering. And then he weeps, not only weeps, but then he's also angry. I mean, it's a textbook on a well-differentiated leader.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting to me because it seems like the gospel calls us, Dusty, out of both of those corners and into a place that embraces a healthy sense of self and also a healthy sense of connectedness. And though Edwin Friedman isn't using gospel categories, he essentially works out the same thing. He says a healthy self-differentiation is not apathy. It's not isolation. It's not nothing can touch me, but nor is it enmeshment. It's this ability to connect while remaining distinct. It's that ability to know where do I end and where does someone else begin? And I can have both that kind of differentiation and a real healthy ability to sympathize with others. And I think what Edwin Friedman's trying to push back on is to claim that you can't have both those things is wrong. Like you actually can't have real sympathy unless you have a healthy sense of self.
I think it's helpful if I'm a very cognitive person to do what you're saying, Chris, which is like lean into, pray for compassion, mercy, things like that. If I'm a highly emotional person, I need to go slow. Now that's really watering it down. It's not that easy because you could be both cognitive and emotional,
sure,
right?
Sure.
And you need to be fully human. But I think I'm going to drift towards one or the other. I also think, as I was reading this article, this is why asking questions is really important, because the art of asking good questions keeps me in the sympathetic lane. Mm-hmm. When I don't have to insert my feelings and I don't have to take up what you're actually feeling, but I'm human enough to feel something, I can help you, Chris or Bob or whoever, by actually dialing in, getting more information, asking the right types of questions that are loving and guiding you in whatever we're working on.
I just remembered this quote from Alistair Roberts in this Joe Rigney article that I found helpful. I guess it's not a quote. He's saying this is, he's basically giving credit, saying, hey, Alistair Roberts was the first person to have this observation. Empathy is often primarily oriented to the feelings of sufferers. Sympathy is primarily oriented to their good.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really helpful distinction, because if I'm oriented towards someone's good, that's actually a higher good than just being oriented toward their feelings. If I'm just oriented toward their feelings, that's good. I'm going to enter in and care about them. But being oriented toward their good means I also want to help them sort out, hey, what are those feelings are good and godly, and what are those feelings are need to be brought before the Lord and changed or healed or transformed. And so that orientation towards someone's good can be is a helpful grounding thing for me when I have to have hard conversations with people and say, like, hey, I need to tell you some things that are going to be painful for you to hear. But why would I do that? Well, because I'm for your good. And I want to help you see something or engage something that you might not want to see or engage for the sake of the greater good of where that's going to bring you. Let me end the podcast with Joe Rigney's conclusion. I simply want to insist that comforters maintain their integrity while joining others in their pain. Call it preserving self-differentiation. Call it avoiding enmeshment. Call it rejecting corrupt and unhealthy empathy. Call it resisting the idolatry of feelings. Call it maintaining allegiance to Jesus. Whatever you call it, it's refusing to be totally immersed in the feelings of another. It's refusing to concede what should not be conceded, and resisting attempts to subordinate truth to the feelings and sensitivities of the most reactive and immature members of a community. It's moving deliberately and intentionally into the pain of others while clinging to Jesus for dear life. It's a good call. A good challenge to us all.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We love to hear from listeners, so if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next Wednesday for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.